So hello, welcome to, God, how, can you start, Peter? I'm too fucking brain dead for this.
Hello, folks. We are, well, fuck, I don't know how I'm starting.
It feels fake. It's like recording an answering machine message.
Yeah, it really does. Hello, folks, and welcome to a bonus episode of If Books Could Kill. We want to preface this by saying that we recorded this conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion a couple of months ago, before things really popped off.
Before we learned of the troubling plagiarism that is rife in our elite institutions.
So we're not going to talk about Claudine Gay and Harvard per se. We're not going to talk about the goings-on at Boeing.
Very tough stuff.
But the good news is that next month, we're going to do another bonus episode where we talk a little bit more directly about that stuff and about Bill Ackman's ongoing meltdown about DEI and DEI adjacent things.
We didn't want to do it to him, but the world made this a part one.
That's right.
Recent events. I also want to apologize for us being late with our latest episode over Christmas. I came down with some sort of fucking Paleolithic mega flu, and I have basically been ill since Christmas. Like, it's going on a month now, and like, the doctor thinks that it's bronchitis. My friend with RSV thinks it's RSV. I am an anxiety Googler whenever I get sick, so I think it's terminal brain cancer. I have no idea what the fuck it is, but I am working, sprinting to try to get Steven Pinker's 850-page nightmare book finished. It's not helping that it's like the longest fucking book I've ever done for this show, but we are trying to get our next episode out like as quickly as possible.
And I don't want to freak you out, but I also kind of think it's terminal brain cancer.
Thank you. Thank you for your support, Peter.
Just based on the way you've been texting, you know.
Feed my worst impulses, Peter, please. So here is our episode about diversity, equity, and inclusion, which we're calling our Opus DEI.
Oh, my God.
Peter.
Michael.
What do you know about diversity trainings?
All I know is that this is the first bonus episode for which attendance is mandatory.
So this is a little Mike episode, or like Mike half episode. I feel like we've been relatively transparent about the fact that our bonus episodes are sort of like leftovery or like things we didn't quite get to in various episodes.
Mike only has 55 pages of notes and did 12 hours of research for this episode.
Well, this one is sort of like leftover stuff from the Yasha Monk episode, for which we already fucking recorded for 5.5 hours and like didn't get to an entire chapter. So I was like, okay, I want to talk about this shit because I'm really mad about it. But also like, man, Mike, know when to stop. So we're now doing this as like a little addendum. But then I did a bit more research on this whole thing about fucking diversity trainings, because we're now on like year fucking four of this being like a nationwide moral panic. And we're all talking about fucking diversity trainings nonstop now.
Diversity trainings are such an interesting little flashpoint in our culture wars. I was an employment lawyer. I saw this shit up close. Mm-hmm. I'm also relatively sympathetic to both advocates for DEI in the workplace and the people who say it's stupid within certain confines.
Same. I feel like it's kind of similar to our Hillary Clinton episode, where it's like she's wildly problematic in various ways, but also she's subject to all these unfair attacks at the same time.
Yeah.
Actually, okay, can I go into my spiel, Peter? I have a spiel on this before we get going. I have a table setting spiel.
Sure.
So as you know, I worked in human rights for 11 years, and all of my work focused on corporate human rights violations. Like, that was the topic that I worked on for my entire career. And one of the things that I used to do is companies would like hire us to kind of go and like inspect their operations. So like I at one point spent 10 days on an oil company compound in Kazakhstan. And then like we would give them a report of like, this is all the ways you're violating human rights. And like, you should stop doing that. Like that was my job for a long time. I think this has kind of gone under the radar. But one of the things that I noticed doing this, especially with sort of heavy industry type companies, is like how much occupational health and safety shit these companies are doing. There's been this like actual like revolution, especially among like large multinational corporations, to have like all kinds of crazy health and safety stuff in the workplace. Like in Kazakhstan, they wouldn't like start the engine of a car like driving you from one part of the compound to the other unless you had your seatbelt on. And like even at the headquarters of a lot of these companies, it's like they make you hold the handrail when you go down the stairs. Mm-hmm. And throughout most of these like large multinationals, there's like so many things that they're doing, right? That's like you can get fired. Even in like random like HR departments and shit, you're held accountable for like how many on-the-job accidents there are. And worker surveys every year, like satisfaction surveys, include all these things of like what health and safety risks are you seeing at the workplace? And you get rewarded for like coming forward about health and safety risks. I could keep going. I'm obsessed with this shit. I think it's super fascinating because as a guy who was like trying to get companies to do human rights shit, I would always bring this up to them as this is what it looks like when a company takes something seriously. Uh-huh. When we would say like, oh, maybe stop like polluting this river out back behind your operations, they'd be like, oh, we couldn't possibly do that.
Right.
Like you're doing all kinds of other like kind of impressive shit as far as reducing injuries. You just don't really want to do the environmental stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Companies are doing all kinds of shit like up and down the corporate ladder on occupational health and safety stuff. They are also doing occupational health and safety trainings. And so trainings, like worker trainings on sustainability issues, can be part of like a comprehensive effort to actually address these issues, right? They can also be cynical fucking lip service, right? Where you're like, you give a diversity training, but like you don't actually give a shit, right? You don't track these things. You don't judge any employees on like, you know, their diversity metrics. You don't make any attempt to hire from diverse groups. It's just like, yeah, do the fucking training once a year. And like, then if we get sued, we can like defend ourselves. And so from the outside, it's very difficult to know if companies are doing diversity trainings as part of a cynical effort to deflect criticism or whether they're doing it as a comprehensive effort to increase diversity and like implement meritocracy within the company.
Right.
And so my own duality with this is that like, yeah, they might be good and they might be bad, but you have to put it in context of everything else that the company's doing.
Yeah, that's a good framework. And maybe one component of this conversation is the general cynicism of these companies, which feels, given the fact that so many companies that have terrible diversity numbers, right? Yeah. Where like you can see what their employee demographics look like and note that they are more white, more male than they should be, especially in the C-suite, etc. Mm-hmm. So many of those companies count themselves as like champions of diversity.
Yeah.
You know, I want to say to sort of frame up how I think of this conversation and how I think about workplace DEI.
Yeah, what's your spiel, Peter? Give me your spiel.
On one hand, the goal of diversity in the workplace, admirable and good, right? Not only because it serves as like a corrective for historical wrongs and present ongoing discrimination, but because there's a pretty solid body of evidence that diverse workforces are just more productive and effective,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And there are different theories about why that's the case, but I think it's safe to say that workplace diversity is a good thing by every practical metric, right?
Yes.
And I say all of that hopefully to establish that the next thing I say is being said in genuine good faith.
You want that echoing as people listen to the next 3 minutes.
And that is that workplace DEI, in its most common iteration, simply does not work.
Yeah.
If you looked at the research for this, I imagine that you stumbled across Frank Dobbin's work.
Mm, yeah.
Dobbin and Alexandra Kolev published a sort of analysis that came to several conclusions. One, short-term educational interventions tend to be ineffective, like as a general rule.
Mm-hmm.
Two, anti-bias interventions can actually like activate bias.
Right. You're making it salient to people.
Right.
When it kind of wasn't before. Yeah.
Three, training tends to make people complacent in certain regards. Four, people react negatively in general to like attempts to control them, right?
Right.
You basically need these like much more extensive interventions with your employees.
There's a quote from one of my favorite philosophers that I come back to a lot, which is the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. I forget his name, but he's great. I love his work.
That's the kind of sharp observation that mm-hmm. can take you all the way to the top.
Unproblematic fave.
And this is what is so difficult about having these discussions for me is like, mm-hmm. I don't think that this type of training is useful, mm-hmm. but then it gets molded into something completely insane by the right, where they take this rhetoric that I don't love mm-hmm. and they represent it as something that it's just not.
Right.
What we're actually talking about is a cynical or semi-cynical effort by corporations to sort of like co-opt and take the heat out of a very powerful social movement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I mentioned this in the Identity Trap episode, but like if you see that sort of cynical effort on the part of corporations and you think that it's sincere, you are a sucker.
Correction. You did say that in our recording for Identity Trap, but you did not say it on the episode because I cut it out because we recorded for 5.5 fucking hours, Peter, and I cut out like right, 2/3 right. of what both of us said. So we're going to have that here for the first time.
People are demanding more Peter. All the cool things I said must be put back in.
So as in all of these things, I do think some of the context around diversity trainings is like slightly more easier to talk about if we dig into the history. I found mm-hmm. a super interesting article called A Retrospective View of Corporate Diversity Training from 1964 to the Present. So as we were talking about before we started recording, the earliest corporate diversity trainings were basically like immediately after the 1964 passage of the Civil Rights Act, which mm-hmm. made it illegal for companies to discriminate, like any company over 15 employees couldn't discriminate. And weirdly, like one of the punishments for discrimination was that they would have to institute mandatory diversity trainings. So a lot of companies just like did the diversity trainings anyway. But at the time, all the diversity trainings were like, it seems like they were much shorter and they were exclusively focused on like legal compliance. Like here's what you can and cannot do in the workplace.
Yeah.
There's a quote from this article, which I think is really interesting. This is about the earliest anti-discrimination trainings. It says, recipients of the early anti-discrimination training often left with a variety of emotions, few of them positive. Because the training focused primarily on treating historically underrepresented minorities and women fairly and equitably in white male-dominated environments, non-members of these groups resented their exclusion and felt that the preferential treatment was being afforded to the targeted groups. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I do think it's worth noting that from the earliest days of these trainings, basically, white people were casting themselves as victims, right? Like, aren't we doing too much for, like, women and black people in the workplace? These were the workplaces of the 1960s and the 1970s, of course, right?
Right, right.
And so after the sort of legal compliance stuff, the entire field goes dark during the Reagan administration, mostly because he appoints Clarence Thomas as the head of the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which I think is just like so fascinating how this kind of top down thing happens that it's like, oh, the administration doesn't give a shit about this. And like, we're not really going to get busted. So like, we're not going to give a shit about this for a decade, basically. It then gets resurrected in 1987 due to an airport bestseller called Workforce 2000. Which was one of these things, remember like Mega Trends 2000? There was like a whole kind of cottage industry in the late 80s and early 90s being like, where will we be in the future? Like all these kinds of prediction books.
Yeah, of course.
It was like, look, the workplace is going to be much more diverse, like younger Americans. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of business people like read this in mm-hmm. O'Hare and then started doing all these like much more kind of holistic diversity efforts. And the funniest thing about these was that like people were kind of, I guess, doing their best, but also these organizations were mostly, you know, white male dominated, the same way many of them are now. And it was like a bunch of white dudes trying to create these trainings. What they did was they created all these trainings that were like, instead of telling white people that they should be cool with minorities, we're going to tell minorities like how to fit in corporate America.
Nice.
So they started designing all these trainings like for minorities of being like, this is how to like deal with white people and shit. So they just came off like the whole kind of project was like even more patronizing to people that were like minorities in the workforce.
Okay.
And then
yeah.
in the 1990s, partly because basically the market for these trainings was expanding, this is when we have the appearance of like the diversity training industry. Mm-hmm. Like you start having these like companies crop up that do this as a specialty. So By 2003, this was already a billion-dollar industry.
And now that's Robin DiAngelo's net worth.
One of the things that I think is like the core problem mm-hmm. of this entire, like the fact that it's an industry and the fact that trainings are like the methodology by which a lot of companies like want to do diversity stuff is basically there's no real best practice. Mm-hmm. Here, this is a great encapsulation of it from the actual article. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. to me encapsulates like the sort of Wild West nature of like the burgeoning diversity training industry at this time. So this is about the exercises that they would have people do in these actual specific trainings.
Another popular exercise during this period was called adjectives. Designed to help participants understand stereotypes, it required them to write down the first words that came to mind when they thought of different groups such as African Americans, Latinos, Asians, women, people with disabilities, and people over 40. Participants then posted the stereotypes for everyone to see. There is no way I would
There's
fall
no
for this
fucking
bait.
Way.
Like,
I'm
never taking this bait.
That was my first thought, too.
I'm just writing down, like, human nope. being, human being, human being.
Great, generous, oh my wonderful, God. Yep.
Even though facilitators were careful to point out that this did not necessarily reflect participants' feelings about the groups, most generally believed that the words, mostly negative, reflected true feelings. For example, common descriptors for blacks included lazy, looking for a handout, uneducated, and whiners. Adjectives for women included soft, sensitive, and not as physically strong as men. In contrast, white men were often described as strong providers, protectors, and leaders.
Guys.
With insufficient time to adequately explore the historical and sociological roots of these generalizations, participants were left needing much more debriefing, and in many cases, healing.
So it's basically Diversity Day right, from the right. office.
Dude, I would love to find the fucking Nazi that thought of that idea.
Jesus Christ.
Doesn't this feel like a right-wing troll?
God.
Like some guy who's like, I bet I could trick everyone into just writing down racist stuff.
But this is the thing, though, is like the way that they're marketing this to like HR managers and C-suite people is like on the basis of these fucking exercises, right? And no one knows that like, this probably isn't appropriate. Like there's no such thing as state of the art in the field because everybody's just making it up. And so one of the things they mentioned in this history is that I think this probably applies now is there was a huge range of actual content of these trainings. And some of them were like, diversity is great. And like America is a place where everybody gets along and things are great. And people come out of these diversity trainings being like, wow, we have nothing to work on. This is awesome.
Yeah.
And then others were like systematic discrimination and like the legacy of slavery and all this stuff. And then
right.
people are like, why am I talking about this at work?
You're painting sort of interesting picture. You have these independent like diversity consultants who sell their shit to C-suites who are trying to sort of present a certain image to their employees, to potential applicants.
Yeah.
And all of it sort of like conjures up the image that this is a grift. But everyone I've ever encountered in this space feels like a good faith operator to me.
Totally. I think that's absolutely what's happening. Yeah.
One thing lurking here is that American civil rights law does not technically allow you to target minorities.
I know,
right?
It's so weird to be doing it in this context.
And this is why we keep talking about anti-bias training.
Yeah.
Because when you start talking about systemic discrimination in more specific ways, it becomes a little more precarious legally because mm-hmm. you might have to actually talk about race in a much more express manner.
Yeah.
And if someone wanted to diversify their workforce, the most obvious way would be to discriminate in the legal and literal sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
you can't do that. You can't do yeah. that. Instead, we have to have anti-bias training.
So this kind of gets us to the next chapter. Before we talk about the current panic, I do want to take a little detour into like the research on whether or not these trainings work. The kind of TLDR is that like there's not that many studies. And most of them are just kind of correlational, right? It's like mm-hmm. it could be that companies that are more diverse are more likely to have diversity trainings, or that companies right. that have diversity trainings are more diverse. Like it's really hard to untangle that. Not that many of the studies mention this, but there's a good meta-analysis that mentions that there's just like massive publication bias because we're talking about companies increasing their diversity. And the only companies that want to essentially brag about this are companies that have diversity programs that quote unquote work.
Right.
Like companies that are like, oh, we did a diversity training and a whole program and like, no, we're still 99% white. They're not going to like tell academics about that. So it's just really hard to kind of know what these trainings are doing. But we can also say that there's essentially just no evidence
right.
that these trainings make any difference.
And even when you sort of address all of these underlying concerns, there's evidence that successful anti-bias training doesn't actually reduce workplace discrimination mm-hmm. because workplace discrimination is not simply the results of individual biases in the aggregate. It's the result of systemic discrimination, right? Which takes all of these different forms, how we hire and fire, how layoffs are conducted, how performance reviews are structured, all of these things that exist outside of individual biases and perhaps aren't the real driver of discrimination. Mm-hmm. I remember a training from early in my career where I was sort of scoping out a diversity inclusion seminar thing. Mm-hmm. It was like a fucking Hands Across America kind of vibe. I don't know. Like they talked about race, but like other stuff too. It was so like on the nose satire of woke people.
Okay.
You know, my team sent me to be the lefty who's like looking at it. And then my Republican colleague also went, and he's like looking at me.
Like, you're responsible for this?
I think he was, like, looking at me being like, is this what Peter thinks is, like, a good training? But there was such theater kid energy, and they were like, you know, what you need to do is have your employees thinking about race and talking about race. And I was like, this is the worst.
Yeah.
One of our other lawyers is this black guy. And he was just like, oh, no. Like, this, like, we can't be doing this.
As a gay person, I want to feel, like, welcome and supported and safe at work. I don't want people asking me about, like, my experiences as a gay person.
Right.
We have talked many times on the show about how, like, I think the concept of microaggressions is, like, genuinely useful. And I think it's, like, useful in these trainings. I think people should know that, like, you can be a very well-meaning person, but constantly asking somebody and highlighting somebody else's minority status creates like a friction for them.
Yeah.
Even if they're doing it in a genuinely good faith way, I don't want people at work to be like, what was it like growing up in the closet, Mike?
Right.
I'm like, I just need you to get this to me by Wednesday. I don't want to like have this deep like relationship with you necessarily. This is like very personal stuff.
Right.
It puts this weird onus on minorities where like there isn't an equivalent that I can ask like a straight person about, right? It's like if you start asking me about like the traumas I've experienced as a gay person, I can't really get any dirt on you as a straight person in the same way.
Well, we have the hardest role, which is savior.
Fix me, Peter.
The research bears this out too, where being constantly reminded of race, for example, does make people uncomfortable. You know, black people don't walk around thinking like, I'm black and I'm doing work. I'm black and I'm getting coffee, right? But a lot of white people process black people, other people of color like that, right?
Yeah.
They look at them and they're like, black person at work, right? Like, it's like the first thing they think about. And so allyship to them becomes being like, hey, what's up? It's cool that you're black.
The first sexual harassment training that I ever went to was, I mean, I probably shouldn't say, but they had a anecdote that was apparently true and had actually happened at this company. I was like 19 years old. I had never attended one of these kind of trainings
anymore. Classic training mistake to be like, here's an example from your colleague.
Yeah, that's the thing. They might have been making this up. And like in hindsight, I kind of hope that they were making it up because there's like enough identifying details in this story that I easily could have figured out who it was. But apparently they had a lesbian employee who thought that like because she was gay and like married and lived in the suburbs and whatever, she could like kind of sexually harass people with impunity. I think this is like an actual thing that like some gay people are like, I can comment on your tits because I'm gay, which like is not.
No.
Which is not the case.
Every straight guy knows the gay guy who only seems like 80% down the spectrum to fully gay, who's like grabbing your girlfriend's tits and you're like, come, like, bro, I know sexuality is a spectrum. Okay, you can't be doing this.
But apparently this lesbian employee, when people were at their desk and like leaning forward doing computer shit, if she could see their butt crack, she would take out her credit card and would like swipe, like physically swipe the credit card in their butt crack. And like, I remember them telling us the story and just being like, I think I know that I'm not supposed to like physically touch people's butt cracks.
If you're a young employee at the workplace, you might think that you can physically swipe a credit card up the ass of your coworkers.
I was like, this was literally my first sexual harassment training. And even at that stage, I was like, I was not going to do that. I just as a human being, I've been in like social situations before.
To even do that to your credit card, just like your credit card's been in the ass cracks of like 20 colleagues.
I can't imagine my reaction to having someone do that to me.
I mean, exactly. I would literally just like march with the credit card in my butt crack to HR.
No one could make up that story. Like no one who runs these trainings could make up that story. That is a real story. It might not be from your company, but that is a real story. Someone was doing that somewhere for sure.
Although I will say, in defense of this training, I think one of the reasons I remember it so vividly, other than like the banger anecdotes and the fact that it was the first one I ever had, is that it was not particularly like ideological. It was not trying to change any of my underlying beliefs about gender in society. It was basically like, if you have feelings for a colleague, are you allowed to ask them out for coffee? If you start dating, when should you tell HR? It was all stuff that was like very procedural and very relevant. And yeah. I think the question of like, do diversity trainings change people's biased beliefs about race is not the question to ask, because of course they fucking don't. Nobody knows how to even measure biased beliefs, much less change either implicit or explicit bias. Like, this is a societal problem that is not going to be solved by diversity trainings.
Yeah.
What these trainings can do, however, is communicate the values of a company. Mm-hmm. If you think about a company onboarding, there's all this propaganda about like what we care about here at Walmart, right? The customer comes first. I think right off the bat, telling employees and like on an ongoing basis that this is a place where everybody gets to feel safe,
yeah,
right? A diversity training is not going to change people's underlying beliefs about whether trans women are mm-hmm. women. What a diversity training can do, however, is say, you will use the correct pronouns for people at this job or else you will be fired.
Yeah.
That is like actually really important.
Right.
And when I think about, you know, the human rights trainings that I delivered to companies when I was doing this, we weren't trying to get people to like care about the Rohingya. What we were doing was teaching people how to identify human rights violations.
Right.
If you see somebody in one of the company's operations that looks under 18, what do you do about that, right? If you see your boss saying something to another employee that you think constitutes harassment, obviously you can't go to your boss about it, right? Do you know about the company's grievance procedures? Do you know that you can file an anonymous complaint?
Right.
These sort of procedural things, I think, is actually like really important that people know this.
I think companies that have sort of ineffective DEI initiatives tend to present their wins as like this abstract thing about raising awareness in the workplace. And I think part of why you get so much resistance to these initiatives is that people just generally don't like being patronized by their employer in this sort of sense, right? And part of this is always going to be psychotic conservatives, right? But another part is just sort of like moderates, people who have like some reactionary tendencies, who are going to be off put by this in a way that they can't quite put their finger on. And I think it's very common for liberals and people who put these initiatives on mm-hmm. to sort of write those people off as like, well, yeah. they need to get in line. But if your actual goal is to create a workplace where women and people of color, people from different countries, all feel comfortable and have equal access to workplace opportunity, you need to change the behavior of those people too.
Yeah, yeah,
if
yeah.
you can't change the behavior of people who are skeptical of diversity initiatives, that's a flaw in your model.
Well, yeah, I feel like the final stage of this is probably like what happened after 2020.
Uh-huh.
Like I did some research of just kind of like anecdotally looking over like what companies were doing after 2020. And like a lot of companies put out public statements and made these like commitments to diversity. And like,
yep.
I think a lot of the cringe stuff is like a relatively new and a relatively isolated phenomenon that like comes out of this very specific moment in like summer of 2020.
Yeah.
Did you notice a difference?
Being an employment lawyer during 2020 was hell on earth, Michael.
Yeah? Like noticeably?
I have such fucking severe PTSD from this. Like, it was one of the dumbest times on earth. And the funniest part of it was how every single company put out a statement being like, what we're really looking to do is have a discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's
yeah,
all
yeah.
talk, right? And so you sort of open up the floor for comment. And then you get weirdos being like, yeah, I want to talk. I want to talk about how the riots are being done by Antifa. This was happening at like every fucking company. I was talking to all my friends about this. Every company was like, we're ready to like listen and learn and talk.
Right.
And then like an actual discussion amongst employees started to happen. And then within 6 months, they were like, we are going to stop talking. That will be the end of talking.
I think this, we're about to get to the sort of extremely bad faith moral panic about this. But like, I'm willing to give people kind of a pass on that period, right? We were in the middle of the pandemic. People were, everyone was on just online too much. We were all fucking losing our minds. And like, people wanted to help, you know, George Floyd and the protests and everything. It increased people's awareness of structural discrimination, but it didn't increase their ability to do anything about it. Uh-huh. And I think we had this period immediately after where like everyone wanted to help somehow or like do something, but it's so fucking hard to know what to do. And also you had this massive population of basically like middle-aged white people who like were kind of clueless about this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they changed their diversity training person, or maybe they put like a post up on Instagram or whatever. It was this time of, I think, clumsy efforts to address these very real problems.
I think that the sort of conservative media ecosystem is well practiced in taking these social movements and undermining them.
Yeah.
One, they sort of latch on to instances of rioting and violent protests,
mm-hmm.
make the entire discussion about those instances, mm-hmm. frame the movement as defined by those instances.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they latch on to the worst demand, most aggressive demand of the activists.
Yeah.
All of that is sort of par for the course in the conservative media world, right? Like,
yeah.
When Ferguson happens, they did some version of this, right? If anything, 2020 was sort of the climax of this ongoing fight that the conservatives sort of successfully managed to bring to a standstill.
Yeah.
And I think that they were able to bring all of these things together, all of like the frustration, all of that sort of like pearl clutching, bring in even harmless things like DEI, right? And make this part of like a comprehensive complaint mm-hmm. about the state of the left, right?
Yeah.
I think that was like a fairly successful operation by conservative media.
I mean, this kind of brings us to the genesis of this entire panic. So at the time, Chris Rufo was like in Seattle. He was like the go-to conservative commentator on homelessness, even though he just fucking lied constantly.
What do you mean, even though he just lied? Because he's just lied constantly.
But he was just sort of like our little like token conservative guy. And then he, in July of 2020, gets a leak from a City of Seattle employee with like slides from a diversity training that they had done. And he does a thread on Twitter about like how stupid this is. Mm-hmm. So he says, the City of Seattle held a training session for white employees called Interrupting Internalized Racial Superiority and Whiteness. So I did a public records request to find out exactly what this means. First, diversity trainers informed white participants that objectivity, individualism, intellectualization, and comfort are all vestiges of internalized racial oppression. The City of Seattle diversity trainers encouraged white employees to practice self-talk that affirms their complicity in racism and work on undoing their own whiteness.
Uh-huh.
And this goes on. I mean, there's all these examples. It does appear to be quite a silly training.
Uh-huh.
But like, it was a voluntary training. And
yeah.
It was on a day when all of the white employees were going to like not show up to work as like a show of solidarity for Black Lives Matter because the protests were going on.
So they chose training day?
It's not clear to me if like anybody actually went to this training. I feel like there's also something where like they exaggerate the sort of the mandatoriness of this.
They want to conjure up an image of like the white employees are being funneled into a room and disciplined, right?
The whole concept of like indoctrination kind of makes sense when they talk about it for kids, I guess. But it's like when you're talking about adult municipal employees,
yeah.
I just don't think this idea of like they're being propagandized and brainwashed really works. I think most people see this stuff and they're like, oh, I don't know about that.
Like Rufo does make the claim that it's indoctrination, but I don't think that that's the salient claim. I think that what really resonates with like moderates with reactionary tendencies is the idea that this is transparently dumb, mm-hmm. and yet liberals have sort of lost it so much. They're so detached from what's normal mm-hmm. that they think that this is like a reasonable training, right? I think right. that's the message that actually sticks in the brains of like your average Republican voter, for example.
Yeah, and to give those people some credit, I think you can object to the vehicle through which these messages are being delivered without objecting to the messages themselves. Like, I actually think it's very important and useful for people who are members of majority groups to reflect on the way that they benefit from societal structures. I think this is actually like an important thing for people to be doing on the merits. Uh-huh. I also think it's a little weird to be doing that reflection guided by like Susan from HR. And also it's very obvious that the conservative complaint about these trainings is not about the vehicle. It's about the messages themselves and the objective of these trainings.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about, you know, Chris Rufo basically inventing this DEI panic is that then, you know, once he does this thread that goes like mega viral and shows up on all the, you know, Daily Caller and everybody sort of aggregates it, this then creates a market for him. So then other people, dozens of other people start quote unquote leaking him
yeah.
the internal training materials from their own training. So it's basically a bunch of angry white people being like, look at this dumb bullshit we had to do at work. So within 48 hours, he's on Tucker Carlson. Within 2 weeks, we have Trump's executive order on right. diversity trainings. Apparently, he goes through the footnotes of these trainings and he finds, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw, Derek Bell, and all these critical race theory scholars. And like, yeah. that's where he pulls this dumb critical race theory panic from. And within weeks, the entire conservative apparatus uh-huh. just like falls into line. I looked at the National Review. I did like a Google quote mark search thing. DEI, mm-hmm. diversity trainings, zero mentions between 2013 and 2020. Immediately after Chris Rufo starts fucking talking about this, there's 10 instances in 2021. There's 40 instances in 2022. Mm-hmm. And then like right-wing think tanks are doing these alleged sort of investigations, like X percent of companies do diversity trainings. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, dutifully, this gets taken up by the center left.
That's me. That's me.
Yeah, and here we are. So I'm going to send you this. You have to guess where I got this from.
If it's just a quote from me on another podcast, I'm going to
This is about Coca-Cola's diversity program.
Confronting Racism, one of the trainings that Coca-Cola offered to its employees through the company's training portal, features a slide telling employees to, quote, try to be less white.
I'm always saying this.
For anybody who might be confused about what this exhortation might entail or how they can possibly accomplish it, the training helpfully elaborates that being less white is to be, quote, less oppressive, less arrogant, less certain, less defensive, and less ignorant. In an accompanying video, the best-selling author Robin DiAngelo, who herself is white, explained that becoming less white would take considerable commitment. It is, quote, a lifelong process. Asked how Coca-Cola decided to attach its iconic logo to such inflammatory content, a company spokesperson insisted that the course was part of a broader training program designed by LinkedIn and used by many major corporations. But that only helps show how commonplace such content has now become across corporate America.
Who's responsible for this passage, Peter? Who wrote this?
I don't feel that the writing style matches 100%, but the vibes feel Matt Iglesias.
Maybe if you got rid of your whiteness, you would be more certain. Less ignorant. This is a Yasha joint, Peter. This is a Yasha joint.
It's Yash.
Back to this. Yash. The reason I wanted to include this is not only because I have a bunch of fucking leftovers from that episode, but also because like what he's doing here is almost word for word what Chris Rufo is doing, mm-hmm. right? He's like, you'll never believe what this slide said, right? They're making you ashamed to be white.
Yeah.
And of course, if you look into his excellent footnotes in his fucking book, you find this basically begins with like some right-wing fucking Washington Examiner person
yeah.
who like somehow found this screen grab, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, this is straight direct line from the far right to the center left.
Right.
And in this classic Yasha way, he acknowledges that like, oh, somebody contacted Coca-Cola and they said it's like part of a broader training package, which like, yes, this was never given to Coca-Cola employees. It is part of like a list of resources on fucking LinkedIn that Coca-Cola like has on its fucking website somewhere.
Right.
So this is just like kind of a dumb thing that if you're really interested, you can click on the Coca-Cola shit and you click on the LinkedIn shit and then like 8 bullet points down, is this PDF and you can look at it and like it's stupid. The whole thing breaks down once you get into the specifics because like, first of all, no one is going to accuse Coca-Cola of like being too fucking woke. Like Google Coca-Cola water and learn all about what the company's doing around the world. But also like, what even is the argument here, right? That like Coca-Cola has resources that people can voluntarily see and like maybe, I don't know, 50 people potentially may have seen at some point. It's designed to make you mad without anyone spelling out what the actual problem is.
What they're trying to sort of convey is that this is a normal thing to hear at a company like Coca-Cola. And I assure you that like it is not.
No.
There's no major corporation in this country where you could put try to be less white on a slide and people wouldn't be like, what?
What?
So you end up having this parallel universe conversation about this shit that's not actually happening. Meanwhile, the actual problem from like the left perspective is that diversity training doesn't fucking work.
Yeah.
Like this stuff, no, this is not increasing diversity.
I think people like Rufo and people like Yasha want us to be debating, are these stupid or not, right? They want to keep the debate at like defending or criticizing the actual content of these things. But the actual debate to be having is, why are we talking about these?
Right.
People are using this as this like own of like the left, like, oh, look how bad these diversity trainings have gotten. But like, was anyone actually thinking that we were going to diversity train our way to a country with less systemic discrimination in it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that anyone was actually making this case.
You know, I've sort of like laid out a lot of my personal compunctions with diversity trainings. And so I'm sort of sympathetic to this like gut level reaction that this sucks.
Mm-hmm.
That said, as an employment lawyer, and I'm going to be careful not to break privilege, even though I'm just going to let my attorney license expire so you can't get me, folks.
Breaking your white privilege, which you learned about in a D'Angelo training.
The complaints that I've heard about diversity trainings from conservative employees, both in-house and as a lawyer at a firm, were some of the most unhinged shit I've ever heard. So I heard a story from a company that I won't name of someone who complained about a diversity training. And the complaint was essentially, I don't think I should feel guilty for being white.
Sure.
And then in that complaint, that written complaint to his boss included his thoughts about black crime rates.
Nice.
And then there was discussion among many lawyers about whether that was racist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, this dude is inferring white guilt from like an anti-bias training where like no one told you to feel guilty for being white. But we can't infer racism from the fact that he just out of absolutely nowhere started talking about black crime rates. Like, what are we fucking talking about, right?
Exactly. I know. That's the thing is like, the ones that we did at HuffPost were like really cringe. It's like, don't call people slurs, which like, I don't know that somebody needed to tell me that, but it was like, it didn't like ruin my day. I wasn't like going on like this like campaign within the company. And there's something, there's a really funny Reason Magazine article by fucking Jesse Single about a lady at like a left-wing university who went to one of these trainings and like had a meltdown about like, I don't want to apologize for being white and all this kind of stuff. And it's this like unbelievably long and like tortured article about it. And it has this like almost parenthetical paragraph where it's like, so to be sure, she was at the Capitol on January 6th, but she makes some interesting points. And it's like, okay, so we're just supposed to take everyone in good faith who like has made hating these trainings like their entire personality.
You know, in terms of what the right wing wants out of this moral panic, we've been having like a very good faith conversation in the sense that we are engaging with complaints about DEI initiatives on their own terms.
We're always good faith.
That's right.
GF. This is a GF podcast.
But in the modern culture wars, no conversation is ever really being had on its own terms.
No.
Right? Everything is a proxy fight for something else. And what DEI arguments are really about is the relative position of white people in society.
Yes.
Right?
Chris Rufo does not object to diversity trainings. He objects to diversity.
Right.
It's very obvious that's what's going on.
The conservative view of social hierarchies is not that they are a bad thing, but that they are natural and just.
Yeah.
And so DEI to them is an attempt to usurp their rightful position in the social hierarchy.
Right.
So the end goal is not like the abolition of diversity trainings. If that were the end goal, this movement would really not be much to worry about, right? Yeah. Like, we'd be like, yeah, look, they're coming at it from the wrong angle, but sure, let's get rid of diversity trainings, whatever.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is trying to create a framework whereby any person of color's position is inherently suspect, right?
Right.
Their merit is perpetually in question. It's not about workplace trainings. It's about building a sociocultural mechanism for reinforcing the existing right. hierarchy.
And also, this would not be a Mike and Peter joint without complaining about the center left. Mm-hmm. One thing that really struck me reading Yasha's book and reading the research for this is that the way that conservatives frame these DEI efforts is like as an alternative to meritocracy,
yeah.
right? We need to get rid of this diversity bullshit so that we can go back to a country where there's meritocracy. But this entire framing, this entire assumption is such fucking bullshit. A lot of these diversity efforts are efforts to ensure meritocracy, right? There is a huge number of like Black people and gay people and people from various marginalized groups who have been driven out of the workforce despite being extremely talented due to the fucking hostile work environments that a lot of these corporations have. And so we're not talking about diversity or merit. We're talking about making everybody feel safe at the workplace so that we can be a meritocracy.
Right.
There's a really good Stephen Jay Gould quote. You know, he's one of the people that pushed back the hardest against this like phrenology bullshit. And he says, "I am less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops."
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're talking about. And what I have seen on the center left in like op-ed after op-ed, you know, this has been going on for years now, is ostensibly liberal writers accepting this framing. Right? Of like, we've drifted away from meritocracy because we're now doing these diversity trainings.
Right.
That's not fucking true.
And that's why we're sort of all talking past each other, right? Because yeah. on the left, diversity is sort of understood as a way to fight against an artificial hierarchy.
Mm.
The right will never see it like that. And I think those like center left types are just functionally conservative on this stuff.
Yeah.
In that they believe that the existing hierarchies are natural.
Right. They see somebody getting fired for like using a slur at work, and they see that as a threat to meritocracy.
Right.
Right. But the actual threat to meritocracy is driving people out of the workforce who are going to feel really shitty when they work in an environment where that happens constantly.
If you want to know like a particular injustice that consistently happens in the workplace, it's not fucking people being fired for like conservative speech. It's people with disabilities not being properly accommodated.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
like what I saw a ton of. Women being terminated in essence because they needed to take maternity leave, right?
Yeah.
Like that shit happens all the fucking time. Epidemic across industries, etc. Meanwhile, these guys are like building a massive narrative out of like a handful of anecdotes about conservative free speech. It's
right.
It's when you're close to this stuff, it's just ludicrous.
I mean, that's true. But on the other hand, I know of at least one person who's been fired just for putting their credit card into people's butt cracks. Who's the warrior for her? Dude, oh my God, can I tell another one?
100%.
Let's just get rolling with the best
harassment stories that we've got.
So again, I have to take like identifying information out of this one, but a friend of mine was working at a company whose sector I will not name in Seattle, and the receptionist at the front desk quit. And somebody was like, "Hey, do you mind like going through her old emails? There's probably like some stuff in there about, you know, various things like mm-hmm. various logistical things mm-hmm. that we might need to keep track of even though she's gone, right?" So my friend was going through these old emails and she sees correspondence, like a long thread of correspondence with a colleague who I'll call Matt, who it started out kind of like innocent, was like, "Hey, it was nice chatting with you at the happy hour. Do you want to go get a coffee sometime?"
Mm-hmm.
And this receptionist lady in her emails did the thing that like they call it a Seattle no, where she's like, "Yeah, that sounds fun sometime,"
mm-hmm.
but doesn't make any move to make it like specific. And then this Matt guy just like kept pushing, like, "What about Wednesday? What about next week?" And she could see like months of this correspondence of basically this receptionist like rebuffing his advances. And
yeah.
eventually this poor receptionist had to like make everything implicit explicit and be like, "I am not romantically interested in you." She then saw in the emails like a string of just like him sending her stuff. And one of the emails, this is on a work email, right? This is like at company.com, right?
Yeah.
This culminated with one of the emails saying, "You know you want my dick in your pussy." That was like an actual, that's one of those ones that like, it sounds fake.
Right.
Like that somebody would actually fucking do that on their work email. And like, of course, my friend was going through this and the Matt guy was still there and the receptionist had quit.
Someone, holy shit. Man, I know that like, there's some, I'm sorry, but this is just,
I like that I've made an employment lawyer speechless. I thought you would have like seen like 50 things worse than this.
I mean, I've seen worse language than that, but there's something that makes me feel like he's a murderer.
Yeah. Oh,
it's not like they were like making out and she said, you know, I want to stop. And then he like texted her that after.
Mm.
This is someone who won't even get lunch with you.
Yeah, I know.
Not by the way that I'm endorsing sending that text.
Yeah.
In the
I know. I like how you started with like, this isn't like all the times I've sent that text. This is different.
there's like the logical leap. Is it wild?
Even though you've said 50 times that you're not interested in me, you are. Like, that is murderer behavior. But also seems kind of common from, like, the women that I've spoken to.
Look, there's one thing we won't do on this podcast, and that's get a female perspective. So we'll never know. Guys getting rejected and then immediately being like, I hate you, you're ugly, is, like, wildly common. I would be surprised if there was, like, a woman who dated actively who had not experienced that, you know?
What's the worst thing you've ever seen in an email?
The funniest thing I've ever seen was someone faking an email that called the person a slur.
Nice.
I don't know. I met him in court and he was just a total oddball.
Did you go to court? I didn't know you did that.
Yeah, back in the day, I used to go to court sometimes.
Did you wear suspenders? Like, no, I'm just a simple New Jersey lawyer. Put on your Delaware accent.
I'm just a boy from the suburbs of Philadelphia. Some people think that maybe they've done so much discrimination that it could be described as systemic.
Maybe the trainings would work better if they were delivered like that.
I would like to one man show it where it's a Southerner up against the Brooklyn guy.
Like Gollum, you're going back and forth.
Brooklyn guy's like, now look, my friend from down south, he's a little bit slow, but he's got the right idea, all right?
I'm imagining you with a puppet now.